Hello, listener, and welcome to what I think is the 50th edition of the Zeitgeist Tapes. 50 editions. It's sort of a very, very sort of sobering moment. My name is Stephen Fielding. I'm professor of political history at the University of Nottingham. And my co-host is Emma Burnell, whose list of attributes and jobs just goes on and on. Currently, what are you doing, Emma?
Journalist, political consultant, and playwright are my three main ones, yeah.
Yeah, so the intimidating sort of troika of all of those things. And as you may remember, listener, we discuss on a semi-regular basis different aspects of culture with a political slant. That usually involves, not always, usually involves watching films, talking about films, bit of telly, the occasional novel, sometimes a play. Well, you all know, listener. I don't know why I'm telling you, because you already know. This is what
After
we do.
50 episodes, you should.
50 episodes. Come on, listener. Come on, keep up. Right. Now, for no apparent reason, this is not really a 50th anniversary, but I think actually it's a really appropriate thing to be talking about. We're going to talk about the Manchurian Candidate, specifically the 1962 film version of the 1959 novel by Richard Condon of the same name. We may or we may not refer to the 2004 remake. Maybe it's better to leave that buried, I don't know. But we're going to talk about The Manchurian Candidate, probably, although some people, because it's so far in the past, it's a black and white film, maybe some of younger listeners, if indeed we have any, maybe, you know, scratching their head. But it's a famous kind of term, a concept, an idea. And it's probably one of the first proper conspiracy films. And it became infamous because in 1962, when it was released, just the year after, came the assassination of President John Kennedy. And the film involves the attempted assassination of a presidential candidate, as well as brainwashing, which was current as a fear in the United States and elsewhere in the 50s and the early 60s, as well as conspiracies generally. It's a film about conspiracies, but it's also a film that, like the novel, kind of parodies almost the idea of conspiracy. Now, I've seen this film many, many times. I reread the novel for the second time for just to remind myself about how good the novel is. And it is really, really funny, very dark comedy. So I like it. I love it. I think it's one of my most favourite films. But Emma, is this the first time you've seen it?
It was the first time I'd seen the proper version. Yeah, I went to see the remake in the cinema, but I don't remember very much about it, if I'm honest. I came to it almost completely fresh, and it was just brilliant. I absolutely loved it. I looked at the time, I was like, oh, 2 hours, why is everything so bloody long? Rare. And actually, it just flew by, honestly. It was so watchable, and I'll tell you how watchable it was. My version on Amazon Prime was completely messed up. It had all this awful pink interference coming over the screen all the time, and I still couldn't stop watching. So yeah, it really was just incredibly interesting and watchable, and so many themes that were interesting and of their time, but also interesting to now. And the whole kind of Red Scare, anti-American stuff, cynicism, cynically used by cynical politicians. And just layers upon layers of conspiracy as well.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it might be helpful to the listener if they haven't seen it or read the novel. And I keep saying, read the novel. I mean, the novel's really good. I mean, I was surprised, because usually when there's a good film, and it's based on a novel, the novel's usually terrible. I mean, they've sometimes they've just taken the basic story, sometimes not even that, and they've turned it into something really cinematic and really good. And then when you go back to the original, it's usually quite poor. This is very different. It stands alone. John F. Kennedy read it and liked it, apparently, ironically. So and it was a great success in its day. But the very, very briefly, the plot is it involves someone called Raymond Shaw, who, along with his company in the Korean War, are kind of kidnapped by the Russians and the Chinese and then brainwashed. And Raymond Shaw is brainwashed and controlled so that he can be controlled when he goes back to the United States. And it's not clear during the film what this is for. And as it becomes slowly apparent that his company was brainwashed, and they were brainwashed in order to ensure that he got the Medal of Honor and became a hero and to help him get closer to what was the ultimate ambition of the communist handlers, which was to assassinate a presidential candidate with the aim of getting, as the vice presidential nominee, one of their own, someone who could be run as one of their own. The irony being that this vice presidential candidate is himself an anti-communist of the McCarthyist sort of type.
I mean, he's clearly McCarthy, isn't he?
He's clearly McCarthy, though he looks quite like Richard Nixon. So I think whether that was deliberate or not, which of course Nixon was an anti-communist too. And in the film, he's going around looking at plots and or finding plots, all completely imaginary, to build up his kind of reputation.
But is he though? Because he's actually just very, very stupid and entirely controlled by his scheming missus.
Well, that's no. You're absolutely right. It's the wife of, who is also the mother of Raymond Shaw. This is how it all, you know, comes together. And she, it turns out, is his communist controller. She is the one that gives him the mission that he should perform. And of course, he's all you know, he doesn't know what's going on because he's been brainwashed. He just still thinks he's just nasty mother. I mean, we should talk about the mother, obviously, and who plays her and everything. So that's kind of the basic plot. And during the film, his commander, Raymond Shaw's commander, Marco, Captain Marco, who's played by Frank Sinatra, who liked the story, he bought the rights for everything. He is slowly piecing together the fact that they've all been brainwashed, and Raymond Shaw, there's something going on with Raymond Shaw. So it's all quite tense. You don't know whether he's going to find out in time, and what is, you know, we don't really know until the very end what is Raymond Shaw's mission, and who is his controller. It's lots of things going on, and it's also very funny. I think there's various bits which are very, very funny too. So it's a kind of a very dark comedy thriller, but it's actually also saying a lot about America from the 50s, about McCarthyism, conspiracism, anti-communism, and all that. I mean, all of that. So is there anything I missed out, Emma? Is there anything you want to bring out before we can maybe talk about Raymond's mother? Because she is. Because that actually, I just came across this on Wikipedia when I discovered, because it sounds like I'm a researcher. Kennedy read the novel and liked it. And they actually were a bit afraid, because by this point, Kennedy was president and Sinatra was a friend, or at least, you know, a hanger-on. And they were a bit, you know, will he be? Because the people that made the film were kind of liberal Kennedys, you know, liberal Kennedy supporters. And they thought, you know, a film about a presidential candidate being knocked off, maybe Kennedy, who's a president, wouldn't really appreciate this. And he said, no, that's fine. I love the novel. But who's going to play the mother? You know, like that was a critical role. But anyway, Emma, before
I think the thing, the key, there are two romantic subplots that don't add much, I would say, to the overall. Why the subplot with Marco, where he just randomly meets this woman and they get on really well, I didn't really understand why that was there at all. I understood more about the subplot for Raymond Shaw, who was in love with this woman who was the daughter of his stepfather's political rival. And his mother originally split them up and then tries to get them back together later, you know, all in aid of controlling Raymond. And I think what's interesting, and then maybe this is our opening into talking about the mother, is that she controls him as a mother and also as a handler. And she makes it clear at the end that she didn't know he was going to be the one chosen to do this mission. And that she's incredibly angry with the communists over this. And actually, she's probably going to do it so that she can have control. And she is none other than Jessica Fletcher herself, Angela Lansbury. So, you know, all those people who had all those conspiracy theories about how much of a mass murderer Jessica Fletcher was, you know, just look back in history.
Yeah, I mean, and Angela Lansbury is really good in it.
Superb.
I mean,
absolutely superb.
You never think she was going to become this cuddly, lovely little, you know, detective and being bedknobs and broomsticks, you know, within a decade and all of that kind of stuff. But as Eleanor Shaw, she, I mean, some people might draw comparisons between Lady Macbeth and say, oh, Eleanor Shaw is a very Lady Macbeth character. No, Lady Macbeth is a very Eleanor Shaw kind of a character. Mm. I mean, that monster. She's an utter, utter monster, isn't she? I mean, the novel actually brings out something which is a bit subtle toward, there's a certain moment that basically she wants to have sex with Raymond, her son. There's incest.
Well, that's interesting because I was just about to say it's quite Oedipal.
Yes, yeah. Well, the novel makes it very clear, and obviously the film, maybe 62, there's a kind of, if you've read the novel, you can see it, and maybe there are clues even if you haven't, but definitely Oedipal. Yes, yes.
Yeah, there are ways in which she holds his face a little too long. You know, as you say, very subtle, but it's there and it adds up.
Yeah.
Yet she is, you know, an absolutely evil, power-hungry character. And of course, and completely in control of everybody, pulling all of the strings, but as a woman in the early 1960s couldn't be the candidate.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But I think, oh yes, it wouldn't have been very credible. I mean, she, like you know, like you say, the Johnny Eislin, who is an idiot,
yeah,
who is the idiot senator who goes around throwing accusations, is basically her puppy, her pawn, her puppet, whatever, begins with a P. I think maybe just useful just to show the clip, because the comparisons between Johnny Eislin and Senator Eugene McCarthy, who, you know, not long before had basically terrorised Washington and had been at the heart of this anti-communist crusade, which, of course, affected Hollywood as an industry more than most, but you know, lots of teachers lost their jobs, all kinds of people lost their jobs and careers and lives were ruined. There's a kind of a parody of Eugene McCarthy's modus operandi in the film, where John Eislin turns up to a press conference that's being given by the Department of Defense, and he just starts standing up and starts throwing around all kinds of numbers and accusations, which it would be very useful, you know, for the listener to hear.
Mr. Secretary, can you explain the proposed cut in budget?
Since, sir, you have asked a simple-minded question, I will give you an equally simple-minded answer. Since no great naval power menaces the free world today, the Navy's overwhelming preponderance of surface ships seems to be superfluous. Hence the cut in budget.
Major, my time is important. How much longer are we going to go on with this nonsense?
Yes, sir. If there are no further questions for the Secretary, I think that'll about wrap things up.
Mr. Secretary, I have a question, sir.
Who are you, sir?
I am United States Senator John Yerkes Eisland. And I have a question so serious that the safety of our nation may well depend on your answer.
Who?
No evasions, Mr. Secretary, no evasions, if you please, sir.
Evasion? What the hell are you talking about?
What kind of foolishness is this?
Mr. Secretary, I'm kind of new at this job.
But I don't think it's good public relations to talk that way to a United States Senator, even if he is an idiot.
I am United States Senator John Hickey's Island, and I have here a list of the names of 207 persons who are known by the Secretary of Defense as being members of the Communist Party.
What?
Who are still, nevertheless,
if you working
in and changing the policy of the Defense Department.
Senator,
I demand an answer, Mr. Secretary. There will be no covering up, sir.
What?
No covering up. You are not going to get your hands
on it. How did you get in here in the first place?
And I deeply
regret
having to say in front of these ladies and gentlemen,
you
and the television and radio audience of our great country, that you no longer have my confidence.
Why, you're an idiot if you're not saying. You're out of your mind.
No longer a matter for investigation by the defense.
Get out of here.
I'm afraid you have lost your conscience.
Get that man out of this room.
This matter is now the responsibility of the United States.
Don't let me out of this room. I will not have him in here, do you hear me? Not ever. If I ever catch you in this room again, I'll throw you out bodily. What do you want? Get out of here.
So that's Johnny Island, who I mean, this is I think one of the really neat things about the film and the novel, which is that you know Eugene McCarthy, you know the senator who was seen to be at the heart clearly of McCarthyism, is presented in the film this sort of Romana Clef, which is a term I'm starting to use a lot now. This Romana Clef. Because Johnny Island really is Eugene McCarthy. He's the idiot. He's the person who is claiming there's these communist conspiracies and is himself being run by the communists to get their conspiracy, you know, going. That is so neat. Very simple sort of inversion of it, but that is so neat and so comic as well.
And I felt like it was quite a good commentary, actually, on the damage that extremist anti-communism did to that position. You know, he had to make a bunch of stuff up because it wasn't real.
Yes.
And he went so far. And I wonder if one of the reasons why Hollywood became so liberal afterwards was because it had been completely, you know, exonerated that it was good to that it would, you know, that there wasn't this crazy left wing thing trying to run your lives.
Did it go away? But it didn't ever go away, though, did it? You know, you didn't ever quite go away. McCarthy died, and obviously he was discredited before he died, and it kind of went away for a bit. But the idea of the communist conspiracy, although it could be held up to laughter at that point, and probably there are a lot of people in Hollywood who were very grateful, you know, just going to look probably therapeutic,
yes,
to do that. It, you know, I mean, given in 1964, just 2 years, you know, after the film, you've got Barry Goldwater, you know, talking all kinds of nonsense. You know, maybe the tidal wave went out a bit, but it never went away.
No, it never went away, and it never will. I mean, in America, it's not always as polarised as it is now, but it is always a fairly polarised country. But what I mean is, and I don't mean this film did it on its own, but I mean that by the time we got to this film, there was such contempt for McCarthyism mainstream contempt for McCarthyism was not only available, but a shorthand.
Yeah.
And that then meant that there was this room for a more permissive society. And that showed up in the culture of the 60s.
Yes. Although, you know, the film itself has a very kind of unfortunate sort of history. Given, you know, like I was saying, it came out in 1962, the year after Kennedy is assassinated. And there is some rumour that Lee Harvey Oswald, who did or did he not shoot Kennedy, saw the film and might have been inspired by the film. You know, that was kind of stuff that was going around. And also the idea that having this film about the assassination or the attempted assassination of a presidential candidate was a bit tasteless having it after the Kennedy thing. And so it wasn't ever shown. It was taken away. It wasn't shown on TV or anything for a couple of decades, I think. So there were people that were saying, oh, it foretold the Kennedy assassination. And then the idea of the Manchurian candidate, that somebody who was brainwashed and would then be a weapon by some force who would then go and kill somebody, that became a thing. I mean, it was meant to be a film and a novel that...
What it actually really foretold was Oliver Stone.
Of course. Yeah, well, that conspiracy. Well, yes. But the irony of the film was it kind of, and the novel was that it kind of parodied the idea of conspiracy, certainly of that anti-communist conspiracy, and yet events lent it to give credence to the idea of conspiracy. I mean, it's kind of cruel in that way.
Well, isn't that how conspiracies actually continue to function? Because you fold the conspiracy theorizing into the conspiracy.
Yes.
That's how it works.
Yeah, I mean, but like I say, it's kind of got tragicomic kind of consequences, but which should be disentangled, because the film doesn't foretell anything. It's of its moment. So Eleanor Shaw is a monster and an infamous monster. You should just watch it just for Angela Lansbury.
It is a powerhouse, absolute powerhouse of a performance.
But then there's Paul Raymond Shaw, her son, and like I say, I've seen this film a few times, and I watched it this time, and he is a tragic figure. He's really sad. He's probably one of the saddest characters, you know, I've come across, you know, in film and in literature. This poor sap who's got this terrible mother, whose father died, you know, in the dim and distant past, who's got a stepfather who's a loudmouth braggart who is only interested in him to exploit his like Medal of Honor and his heroic status. They've got no interest in him except to get some photo opportunities. And then he becomes this mechanism controlled by the communists. And occasionally, you know, he has this moment of love and affection from Josie Jordan, the senator's daughter, who, like, you know, like you say, his mother destroys his initial relationship, and then brings them together for her own purposes, and then they decide that he should shoot Josie's father. I mean, this is a man who is also, he's opened his arms to Raymond. He's, you know, he's kind of offered sort of fatherly love to him, and you know, they decide, you know, brainwash him, go and kill Senator Jordan, and Josie discovers him shooting her father, and he's on order orders that anyone who sees you do this, you have to shoot them too. And he has to shoot the only woman who has given him love and the only person for whom he has ever felt love. And that's kind of the thing that starts him to unravel a little bit, that the tension between what he's had to do and what he's been told to do. But that is just so sad.
Really, yeah, sad. And I think what's fascinating is they make it really clear that he's an unlovable person. And part of what leads Marco to discover the conspiracy is he finds himself saying all these wonderful things about Raymond Shaw, and he's like, I couldn't stand the guy. why am I singing his praises like this? And that cognitive dissonance is what opens his mind to wondering about what's going on. That plus the nightmares that they all have, which are beautifully and very funnily rendered.
Oh, yes, that is so good. Yeah, yeah.
So it's practically the opening scene where there's a speech being given by the Women's Institute to a bunch of young soldiers about dahlias, I think it is. You're terribly, terribly dull. The young soldiers are all listening. And then it turns out that that's what the young soldiers think they're sitting through. But in fact, they are being displayed as brainwashed subjects to this sort of weird 60s auditorium, classic 60s sort of sci-fi architecture of a communist plot between the Chinese and the Russians.
Yes, which is going on in Manchuria, which is why he's the Manchurian candidate. That's got the title. Oh, no, that the bit, the brainwashing, when it, and then it sort of, it combines what the soldiers, where the soldiers think they are. So you got all these, you sort of middle-aged ladies, you know, listening to a lecture on dahlias. And then you've got all these communists who are listening to a lecture or a demonstration about how brainwashed you are. And then at one point, the two kind of come together. Yeah. So you get sort of Chairman Mao and dahlias, you know.
You get the Chinese general talking about dahlias, and then yeah. the old woman from the Women's Institute talking about brainwashing.
Yeah. And when Marco remembers the brainwashing, they're all white, and then when one of the black soldiers, and there are actually, you know, for the early 60s, there's a couple of leading characters, subsidiary, but nonetheless important characters who are black. But when the black soldier remembers it, they're all black. Yes. So it's kind of some kind of little, I don't know what that is, but it was kind of a neat thing they did. But I should say that the brainwasher, Dr. Yen Po, is one of my favourite characters in cinema. Because in the novel, he's kind of a little old guy. He's a bit kind of makes a few little jokes, but he's not really developed. But in the film, he's this twinkly-eyed evil genius.
Yes.
Loving it. And he kind of has little jokes. And the actor, Ki Dai, which thanks to Wikipedia, can now pronounce his name. He wasn't Chinese himself. He was kind of Sudanese, Egyptian, sort of mixed heritage. But he has a great performance. That's a really lovely performance.
I mean, it has to be said that all of the performance in this, I thought, were superb. And Frank Sinatra is very, very good as Marco. And suitably kind of a bit battered, a bit jaded. But hero enough, but dark enough at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, he's kind of weak. I mean, He's not the strong action hero. He's often, you see him sweating, he's under all kinds of strain, you know. And then I think that's where the female character played by Janet Leigh, Eugenie, I think that's where she comes in. Maybe in the novel it's more obvious. She's kind of the strength for him. Without her, he would just sort of, I don't think he would have been capable of doing it. So I think maybe that got lost in the film, but in the novel, I think it's more apparent.
Yeah, that would be my one real criticism, is I didn't really get why she was there. I will read the novel at some point once I forget what happened in the film.
Although I read the novel after the film, and it's so different. There are elements which are so different, so you don't really get it, because I know what you mean. I don't like reading novels after I've seen the film because I can't get the faces out of my head. But it was different for that. But
although it's worse if you read a book and you've really pictured an actor in the role, and then they make it with someone completely wrong for the role, you're like, what?
Yeah. Yes. So, but that's not, you know, I think everyone's perfectly cast, I think, in this. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think we've knocked it on the head, this one. I think we've said everything that needs to be. We haven't said everything that needs to be said, listener, because, you know, that would mean that you don't have to watch the film.
Really, really have to watch the film. It's so good. Honestly, I genuinely think I said to Steve, I think that's one of the best things we've watched since we've been doing this.
Yes, which is very appropriate for our 50th. Yes. And the cinematography, the direction, the script, the music, the very sad music as well. It's kind of making it clear about poor old Raymond. It's so good. It is so good.
Absolutely. It's tight. It's watchable. It doesn't feel, sometimes when you watch an older film, it can feel a bit jarring or slow. And this, it has none of that at all.
It's so much better than the remake. The remake isn't even worth talking about.
No, I think let's leave that one.
Let's leave that bit. So yeah, that's good. So do watch it. I think we say things like that, well, apart from if you don't like it, but do watch it if you can. And then tell us what you think by whatever way you can tell us. So that's the end. So I'm sharing this. So what am I doing? I've got to say, this is only about the 25th time I've had to do this. I should thank Lord Stuart Wood for providing us with the lovely, gentle theme tune, to remind you that this is a political human production, and for whatever platform you've actually heard us on, hopefully not Spotify, because, you know, they've put us on Spotify. We just don't know what to do about that. listen to us on something else. But rate and review us, you know, if you're inclined to do so. And so it's goodbye from me, and it's goodbye from
me. Happy 50th.